True Consequences is a proud member of the Borealis Podcasters Guild.
Look deeper.
True Consequences is a true crime and mystery podcast with stories based in New Mexico and the American Desert Southwest. I'm your host, Eric Carter Lundeen. All right, everybody, welcome to another episode of True Consequences. I'm your host, Eric Carter Lundeen, and I am joined by a very special guest today. I'm super excited to be bringing this person on the show. We are talking with Greg McAleese, who is the creator, the founder of Crime Stoppers. Greg, how are you today?
I'm doing well, Eric. How are you?
I'm doing great. We have a significant time difference. You're across the globe from me.
This is true. I'm halfway around the world in the Philippines. So we're approximately 7,500 miles away.
Oh, my goodness.
Right now, it is Sunday morning here in the Philippines, about 9 o'clock. So,
I want to say thank you to one of my prior guests, Joelle Leah. She is the person who runs the Victoria Martin's Voice Facebook page. And she was on my episode about Victoria Martin's, and she connected me with you. So I want to say thank you to her. And also thank you to you for joining me here. If you don't mind, can we start with a little bit of background on you? You know, how you ended up in Albuquerque and how you ended up starting Crime Stoppers.
Sure. I was born in Canada, actually, and in 1961, my dad was the senior armaments officer for the Royal Canadian Air Force, and he had a choice between two locations that he would be posted. One was Washington to the Canadian Embassy, and the second was here in Albuquerque at Kirtland Air Force Base at the Special Weapons Center. And he chose the Special Weapons Center, and he set up a liaison office between the Royal Canadian Air Force and the United States Air Force. That relationship has continued now for, my heavens, more than 50 years. I grew up in Albuquerque, and I love the city and miss it terribly. I especially miss the great Mexican food that, you know, I grew up with. You know, Albuquerque back in those days, it was a little bit of a different city. It was a city of about 250,000 to 300,000 people. It was always, Albuquerque historically has always had a very, very high crime rate. I went to Sandia High School, played baseball there, and set a number of pitching records in the city of Albuquerque, and then had a athletic scholarship to the University of New Mexico. And so then I ended up becoming a sports writer, or the sports editor, for the state of New Mexico for the Associated Press. And with AP, it's a very, very demanding job with a lot of high stress, a lot of deadlines and everything else. And I developed a bleeding ulcer and almost bled to death. My doctor, who was treating me, said, you know, I think you really need to get into a less stressful line of work. And so I became a police officer. I mean, that's sort of how my brain is wired. I mean, you know, don't give me a challenge that I'm going to miss, because I love challenges. And so in 1973, I became a rookie officer in Albuquerque and worked patrol for 3 years, various parts of the city. My favorite area was Borealis, which was, in those days, it was Police Beat 104, just off the downtown area. Then I had an opportunity to become a field investigator. It was a new program that the Albuquerque Police Department had started. And what a field investigator did was, he was like a uniformed police officer out in the field, or a uniformed detective out in the field. And we did a lot of the crime scene work, making sure that we had fingerprints and photographs and all the other things that go along with a major crime investigation. And that work actually allowed me to then get on a fast track into the investigations division of the police department. And so in 1976, I became a violent crimes detective after only 3 years on the force. It's very unusual to be able to have that kind of an expedited path into investigations. In February, after having been in the violent crimes unit for approximately 2 months, I had the temerity. I mean, I'm dealing with guys that have been working homicide and armed robbery for years. I mean, they were legendary within the department. But I had the temerity to try something a little different. I sensed that there was a great deal of frustration on the part of detectives in their investigations because they weren't getting the cooperation that was necessary from the citizenry in order to be able to solve crimes. The movies and TV like to present detectives as being all-knowing, and they're the ones that dig up all the facts and what have you. But the truth is that most crime is solved because of citizen information. It's some citizen out there that is providing us with a lead, with a piece of information that we can then connect to a specific suspect. You know, when a crime is committed, you've got thousands of suspects initially. And so you want to really quickly narrow the scope of your investigation and begin focusing on a select group or perhaps an individual. That's what we needed. We needed the public to cooperate with us. And so, in looking at you can identify a problem, but why is there a problem? Well, I came up with two basic reasons why we weren't getting the cooperation of our citizenry. One was that they were afraid of retaliation from the criminal element if they provided police with information. And the closer that the citizen was to the actual offender, the greater the fear was and the more realistic that fear is. The second thing is that a lot of people are apathetic. I mean, let's face it, we've got a lot of things going on in our life. The last thing in the world we want to be involved in is some kind of a major crime investigation. But unfortunately, those things do happen, and that's where we really need the citizens to step up and do their role as citizens in our country. And so in identifying the two problems, then I started to develop a plan to overcome the problems. Okay, if people were afraid of retaliation from the criminals, why not allow them to remain anonymous when they reported their information? When you call 911, the first thing a 911 operator is going to ask you is your name, your location, your phone number, blah, blah, blah. They already have your phone number that you're using, but they want to know who you are before they then begin to dispatch a police officer to a particular location. That's for officer safety as much as anything else, because you want to make sure that you're actually sending an officer to a real event.
Greg set out to make this as easy as possible for the public to provide tips to law enforcement anonymously. He set up a system that would provide the tipster a code number, and this is how the tips were tracked. Tipsters would not have to give any self-identifying information as they would be expected to with 911. Greg felt that this was the key to the success of the program. The tip line was a separate number from 911. He told me that he wasn't interested in who the tipsters were. He really just wanted to know what the public knew about the crimes the police were seeking information on. Greg also learned early on in his detective career that informants love money. I mean, who doesn't, right? So, he decided he would need to set up a fund to give rewards to anybody who provided information that would lead to an arrest from a tip.
When you tell people that you're going to allow them to remain anonymous, you have to be able to uphold your offer. It's like a verbal contract with the public. And so you have to honor your word. And so we have gone to tremendous lengths, and I'll get into that in a little while, but tremendous lengths in order to be able to protect the identity of a caller. To me, they are just a code number. And the second thing is that if we were going to use rewards, pay rewards, we couldn't use tax dollars. We had to go outside the department in order to be able to fund these rewards. Why? Because tax money has to have an audit trail, and we would have to know who the money is being given to. But if you go outside the department and raise private funds for a reward fund, then you're okay. You can pay that money in cash. And again, you don't have to have anything, but at the end of the line, it's a code number that was paid, not an individual, but a code number. If we were going to go out and solicit the public for money, I couldn't do it as a police officer. So therefore, we had to create a civilian board of directors to raise the rewards and then manage the reward fund. I didn't want to have any contact with the money at all. And so it became something where we, in seeking the approval of the department, it took about a 6-month process. It wasn't an overnight sensation, but it took about 6 months for the department, after I first suggested this program, for the department to finally approve it. And they were scared to death of it. I mean, they thought this thing had a high degree of probability of just being a terrible disaster. But I had one champion that was behind the whole concept, and that was Bob Stover, who happened to be the chief of police. And Stover, his support was absolutely crucial to being able to overcome the skepticism of the other deputy chiefs, especially my boss, who is the deputy chief of investigations, but also a lot of the other detectives who really sort of thought that this was nothing more than just maybe Hollywood kind of, you know. As a matter of fact, my nickname when we first got this program started, I was Cecil B. DeMacalise, after Cecil B. DeMille, the great Hollywood producer. And as a matter of fact, it sort of stuck over the years. I became Cecil B. But the thing was, is that we had to have a civilian board of directors to collect the funds from the public and then to pay, actually arrange for the money to be paid. That ultimately led to Crime Stoppers becoming a nonprofit corporation. So it is a very, very unique kind of an arrangement that we have with Crime Stoppers and every police department where it's been initiated. The police department will handle the information. They handle the phone calls. They investigate the tips. But it's really the total control of the program is under a civilian board of directors. They oversee the program. They set up the standing rules and the bylaws for how we operated. And over the years, we have had thousands, as a matter of fact, worldwide now, we're talking about millions of volunteers who have served on our board with great distinction. The police department and the public were involved, but now I knew that we also needed one further element, and that was the media. It was very, very important that we had media support for this, because the media really creates the awareness of what we're trying to do. They educate the public as to how the program works. They then will take select cases, unsolved cases. We call them crime of the week. And in the early days, we actually went out to the crime scene and reenacted the crime in order to be able to then try to trigger the memories of people who might have been casual witnesses to a crime. And you know, it they have been a tremendous, tremendous working partner. I mean, we're talking now, we're entering our 45th year of operation. And, you know, and throughout all of this time, we have continued to have the support of the Albuquerque media.
Greg was able to secure a deal with KOAT, a local news station, which was the premier TV news channel at the time. He was also able to leverage a relationship that he had with a former co-worker at the now defunct Albuquerque Tribune to get the Crime of the Week featured on the AM and PM front cover of the Tribune. Not only did Crime Stoppers have a relationship with the most popular TV news station and newspaper, they were also working closely with local radio stations. Greg would record a 60-second recording that summarized the Crime of the Week, and they would play the spot throughout the entire day. The media attention really started to have a huge impact on law enforcement in regards to the quality and the quantity of the tips that they were receiving from the Crime of the Week.
The very, very first case that we reenacted was the murder of a gas station attendant at a Horn Oil gas station at Wyoming and Copper. His name was Michael Carmen. Mike was 19. He was going to the University of New Mexico. Everything, the entire world in front of him. In July of 1976, mid-July, someone drove up to the gas station where he was working, robbed the station, and then for really no apparent reason, shot him at point-blank range with a .410 shotgun and left him to die. And I was one of the detectives who was working that case. So, you know, it was something where it seemed like a senseless killing. And it was one in which I thought there were a lot of elements of solvability to the case. The gas station was located, while it's on the corner of Wyoming and Copper, there are residential areas both east and west of the gas station. Also, Wyoming was a heavily traveled street. This murder happened on a Friday night, early Saturday morning, and we felt as though there was somebody out there who probably either heard the blast of this shotgun or saw the crime in its actual event. And so the reenactment, I've got to tell you, the reenactment was not the greatest bit of television production you have ever seen. I mean, if there was anything that could go wrong, it went wrong for this particular reenactment. The two actors who were to play my bad guys never showed up. It turned out that we figured that they were probably young in age, and so we had arranged for a couple of kids from the Job Corps to play my bad guys, and they got a pass to get off campus and then immediately went to a bar and got themselves drunk, and we arrested them later that night for disorderly conduct. That's another story. But the thing was is that we needed suddenly, we've got the film crew there, it's 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Everybody's sort of looking at their watch. I'm looking at where my actors are to be the bad guys. Nobody shows up, and so I ended up having to recruit my lieutenant to play the shooter, and I ended up playing the wheel man. And we used my unmarked police car, and then the young kid that was playing my victim was a University of New Mexico drama student. Really a very, very serious young man. And of course, he needed to understand his motivation. And I said, well, your motivation is you're going to die. That's the motivation. And so I had arranged to have a couple of blanks put in a 410 gauge shotgun that we're using for our prop. And I figured, wouldn't this be neat? We'll fire a round. We'll get a nice close up camera close up of the blank being fired, some smoke, some loud sound, and everything will be great. Well, that didn't work either, because what ended up happening is that when my lieutenant shot the poor kid who was the actor playing the victim, part of the wadding from the blank came out, and it came out hot, and it hit his t-shirt and set his t-shirt on fire. And so we had to douse the kid with water, whatever water we could find, in order to keep him from burning alive. Yeah, none
Wow.
of this, of course, none of this, of course, made the evening news. But the reenactment went on a Monday night, and at the end of the reenactment, Neil Murray said, "If you've got information about this crime, call 842-8000 right now. Detective McAleese is there waiting for your calls." Typical of my lack of planning for this whole thing, I had only gotten one single line for the 842-8000 number, one line. And so every time that the phone would ring and I would answer it and take the information and then put the phone down, the phone would ring again because people were waiting in queue to talk to me. And the remarkable thing is that the third call that I received was from a person who with information about something that had nothing to do with the murder of Michael Carmen. It was he had information about a gang rape that was 16 months old. A young girl had been her car had broken down in downtown Albuquerque late at night. Carload of guys came by, offered her help, but instead of helping her, they took her out to Tingley Beach, where they raped her. The caller had information about that rape, gave me the names of the three offenders, and within 24 hours, we had that rape solved
Wow.
because we had photographs of two of the suspects, and then we got a high school a picture of the third suspect. We did photo arrays, and then we showed it to the victim, and she immediately identified these three guys. They ended up pleading guilty to the charges and ended up doing time in prison.
Wow.
The phones continued to ring. I was getting other information. I was getting information about drug dealers, about burglars, auto thieves. But my 13th caller hit the jackpot. He was an eyewitness to this crime. He was coming home from a party near where the gas station was located. It was probably a little high, you know, and he saw the crime going down. And he saw the vehicle leaving the scene of the gas station, and that call ended up leading to the arrests of the two offenders in the murder of Michael Carmen. And we convicted one of the two. The other one, we really sort of messed up the prosecution of the case, and ended up losing a lot of physical evidence that we needed in order to convict the second person. But we ended up getting one out of the two offenders convicted, and he went away for life. And but that showed right away. Now, we were able to take that information, incidentally, from caller number 13, and we were able to actually have a search warrant developed within 48 hours. We arrested the two suspects in this case within 24 hours.
Wow.
And so it just showed us that there are people out there with the information, and this program really can tap into that source. that we can get their cooperation and that this program is going to work and it can work. That's how it started. We started with about $7,500 in the reward fund. And if you can believe it, Albuquerque has now paid out in 45 years. We've now paid out more than $1 million in rewards. It's amazing just how long the program has operated and how effective it has been. But to show you again just how this program really got off to such a flying start, the second crime that we were going to do was a series of rape cases at the Windrock Shopping Center. We called the series of cases the Windrock Rapists. And we had a one male suspect who was accosting women shoppers as they were out in the parking lot getting into their cars. He would use chloroform to knock them out. And then he'd drive them in their own vehicles many times, and sometimes in his own vehicle, but he'd drive them out to an industrial area that was nearby with Windrock, where he'd rape them and basically just leave them by the side of the road. And there were eight cases that were documented on this guy. And we had tried a lot of things, just ordinary police work. We were under a tremendous amount of pressure from all of the business owners at Windrock to get this case solved because, I mean, it was really starting to affect business. And at the same time, it was something where we had tried using police women as decoys out in the parking lot, hoping that this guy would try to attack them, and nothing was working. I mean, this guy had lived a charmed life, it seemed. One of the victims had been able to see just a small amount of the guy's face, the offender's face. So she gave us a helped us put together a what we used to call in those days an identikit, kind of a sketch of the suspect. And we used that on the front page of the Tribune when we put this on as our second crime of the week. And we got a call at about, it was about 12:45, maybe 1 o'clock in the afternoon, from a young lady, and she was in panic. And she said, "My God, I just read in the newspaper about someone that you're looking for a bunch of rapes. That picture is my boyfriend. That sketch is
Wow.
my boyfriend." And sure enough, and we ended up putting the case together. The once we had a name and an address to go with who the rapist was. The guy's name was Kevin Baker. They lived out in Rio Rancho, and his mom worked at Montgomery Ward's in at Windrock. And so his mom was as terrified as everybody else about this rapist, and here it was her son. I mean, you talk about something that is just unbelievable. But anyway, so by 6 or 7 o'clock that night, we had developed enough probable cause to be able to execute a search warrant at Kevin Baker's house. And we recovered clothing that he had worn. We recovered items belonging to the victims. He'd like to sort of keep some things as keepsakes, I guess. And then on top of that, we found some chloroform that he had. It was a little can of chloroform. And that put it all together. And ultimately, he was convicted and went away for more than 30 years in prison.
It was incredible for the Albuquerque Police Department to see the success from this simple yet effective program that Greg created. The information that came in from the public proved to be so helpful that the efficacy of the program was no longer in doubt. This led to multiple states and cities implementing Crime Stopper programs. And Crime Stoppers now has over 1,600 organizations in the U.S., as well as several in 29 countries around the globe. And every 14 minutes, a major crime is solved by Crime Stoppers somewhere in the world. They have solved over 2 million crimes since the inception of this program. Absolutely incredible. What an incredible legacy. And just from the idea of wanting to solve a problem, and it turned into this massive thing, that is such an amazing gift to give to the entire world, essentially, right? Like that is so incredible and inspiring. So it may not mean much coming from me, but I do want to say thank you for having that thought and having that idea and being diligent to make it happen and dealing with all the red tape you had to deal with, all of that, because that's incredible. What an amazing legacy.
Well, thank you, Eric. It truly has been a labor of love. And over time, Crime Stoppers has become far more sophisticated. We now have computerized programs where people can actually text in their information. They don't actually have to even call the program. They can text in the information to their local Crime Stoppers program, and it's all encrypted. And people, can do that without having to worry about that being tracked back to their, internet provider or to identify them. And then, of course, the whole key really is the fact that when you take a phone call from someone who has information, you really need to be able to develop that information while you're talking to the person, because this could be a one and done kind of a situation. We might never be able to talk to that person again. So you have to make sure that your information is complete and that it's accurate. That is something we put on training programs around the world, where we're constantly showing people how to develop the information. It's one thing just to say, well, we've got this phone number and people can call. But really, there is an art to this. There's a real science to how we develop that information and make it work.
That's incredible. Yeah, I grew up in New Mexico. I grew up watching KOAT News with my grandparents. And I remember a lot of these things that you're talking about. And I remember, Dick Niffin coming on the news at night saying, this is the crime of the week. And if you have any information, call, I think it was like 842-STOP. Was what it used to be back then.
Yep.
That's stuck in my head.
Yeah, 842-STOP, and then I think it's become now 843-TIPS, 8477.
Yeah, and anyway. Now we have the P3 TIPS now, which is like an application that you can have on your phone. It's so cool.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean it's amazing. How sophisticated this program has become. It's because there's a lot of guys who are a heck of a lot smarter than I am, who are able to, to take the concept and really they've made the presentations of the Fugitive of the Week and the Crime of the Week and everything else so much better than it ever was before.
Some of the things that we're facing here in New Mexico, and I think it's been a little bit of a kind of a back and forth thing that has happened. And you probably will remember some of these things that happened while you were a police officer. We've continuously since the 80s struggled with the overpopulation of prisons and jails. Every time it seems like legislators get that in their head that they need to fix that, it usually results in disaster for the state. Usually what happens is they create these programs that sound really good on paper. They sound really nice. They sound like they're going to be great. We're only going to release people who don't have a felony with a firearm. We're only going to release people that meet these certain criteria. And then you have over and over again, inevitably, that never happens. They end up releasing people who are repeat offenders, who are violent offenders, who have proven to be murderous. And then you perpetuate that continual crime. Do you have any thoughts about, because this pattern in New Mexico, it happens, it feels like every 5 to 10 years, a new Senate comes in and they're like, we're going to fix this problem. And then it makes things worse. And it just keeps happening. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, I have a lot of concern about the criminal justice system, and not only New Mexico, but really throughout the United States. In my opinion, it really needs to be fine-tuned. There's a lot of fixes that have to happen. One of the things that I'm ultimately concerned about is is who our prosecutors are and what their philosophies are. It seems as though there has been a coordinated, very, very sophisticated effort to hire or to elect some in some communities, but to elect individuals who don't have the necessary background or expertise in prosecuting cases. And in addition to that, their philosophy is one in which I think runs counter to the protection, the safety of the community itself. When you begin to think about this, here is a stark statistic. 90% of the crime is committed by 15% of the criminal public. 15%. It is something in which if people understood what the issue is of career criminals and recidivists, then they would insist that these people be put away for longer periods of time to a point where they're no longer in a position where they can begin to victimize the public. And I think that what I'm seeing right now is that there has been first of all, there's been a breakdown in moral authority and political authority throughout the country. I mean, it's I look at what happens in the United States, and I sort of describe it as being like having the country is going through a nervous breakdown. I mean, it's just incredible the lawlessness that you begin to see. In Albuquerque, of course, I stay in touch with an awful lot of my old buddies, and of course, they're beside themselves by what has happened with the department. Albuquerque had a national reputation for being one of the best police departments in the entire United States, and one that was very, very advanced in their relationship between the police department and the public. And we had that close association for many, many years, and of course it's been lost. It has to be rebuilt, and you have to rebuild it from the ground up. I think that ultimately what has to happen is that there has to be a change in the philosophy of policing. This is not an us versus them kind of situation, and it cannot be. And if that kind of mentality continues to exist, you're going to end up having a situation where the problem will become so out of control that it will take generations to fix. But it can be fixed, but it's going to have to take some real calm heads and some people that have the best interest of the public at heart. And I don't have I have to admit, I have a personal bias. I don't really like politicians. I don't trust them. They'll tell you anything in order to get elected. And really, for the most part, their ethics really are terrible. And we've got to get better people running for political office, and people that truly, I think, have the best interests of the public at heart. Instead of supporting special interests or a select little group of people that are have the loudest voices, that's not what this is all about. I mean, you've got to be able to have the safety and the security of the general public at the heart of virtually everything you do. Every law you pass has to have that as a backdrop. And to heck with trying to cater to the whiny voices of people who think that, life has been really, really hard, and it's, nobody ever guaranteed that life was going to be easy. I mean, I think that there really has to be a major change in philosophy, but it begins with the police departments reaching out to the public and saying, we want you to be our partner here, and do it in a sincere manner. Crime Stoppers worked all really from the beginning because that's what we did. We said, we want you to be our partner. And the public embraced that concept. And, you know, and 45 years later, they still support that concept. That has to be the hallmark of what we do. And at the same time, I don't care how hard it is for departments. Sometimes it's not just an ego thing, but it's a philosophical thing to be able to start to recalibrate how you think about working with the public. It can be done. We've proven it. But I'll tell you what, the clock's ticking. The clock is definitely ticking, and things have got to change. And we'll see what happens with the new administration, everything else in Washington. We'll find out whether folks can begin to refocus on not their own petty problems, but begin to refocus on what it is to restore the public's faith in the whole nature of America. I mean, really, because it's been under attack, and it's will continue to be under attack until major attitudinal changes are made.
100%. You know, one of the things that has been frustrating I'm in season 3 of this show now. I've started to see that pattern that I was talking about earlier, where, you know, we have overcrowding, so we try to deal with it, and then it leads to more recidivism, more repeat offenses, and I have to imagine that the morale of the police departments in New Mexico has to be down, because you take these people off the streets, you bring them in, you know, you have a prosecutor who is and judges, for that matter, that are very defendant friendly. And oftentimes at the expense of a victim and a victim's family. And that leads to, you know, lower sentences and all these other things that happen that create more problems, which enables and emboldens that 15%, right? It emboldens them to continue what they're doing, because there really is very little consequence for what they've done. And I've said from, you know, early on in my show that we've got to stop, first of all, allowing DAs to use the litmus test of whether they can win a case or not as to whether or not they should prosecute. I feel like that is a huge, huge problem, especially as it pertains to child abuse. I'm sure you know that New Mexico has not had a great track record with child abuse for the longest time. And that's one of the things that I've been advocating for is really, we need to think about, you know, how can we make it so that these cases, our most vulnerable citizens, you know, the children and the elderly, how can we make sure that these people get justice? You know, everybody deserves justice, but like the politicization of the DA's office has really wreaked havoc on the justice system. And I'm sure it happens everywhere, but, you know, I am so hyper focused on New Mexico that it just drives me crazy to see some of these cases where, you know, like my brother's case, for example, you know, the DA decided back then in the 80s that it was too difficult. It was too challenging of a case. He didn't have a good chance to win. So he just decided not to do anything about it. Meanwhile, the man who was responsible for it has been free for 33 years to harm more kids. It's crazy.
Well, it absolutely is. And at some particular point, there has to be somebody who's going to make a stand. And there has to be some courage, as courage of conviction. And I can, you know, I mean, I can really, really appreciate your frustration, and probably your mom and dad's frustration on this. I mean, it's something in which if justice delayed or justice denied truly leaves you with a total feeling of helplessness and a feeling of cynicism, essentially, towards everything that pertains to the law. I mean, we are a nation of laws. We're supposed to operate under the guidance of those laws. And if you don't feel as though, certain people, now for me, and I automatically, if it's the law, I'll follow it. I mean, I just don't want to ever step outside the law in order to create any hardship for me or my family. But you've got people who absolutely don't care, and they don't think that anything is going to happen to them. And from that particular kind of mindset, that is a incredibly dangerous. You're right about politicians. The problem with politicians is that they're always looking for a quick fix. Classic politician is a mile wide and an inch thick, an inch deep. I mean, they just don't. They just want something that'll look good, sound good, feel good, and keep them in office. And unfortunately, that my bias comes out. But that's the fact that we truly have not had the right people running for office. The people that we really need are public servants. A very, very dear friend of mine is the county clerk in Bernalillo County, and that's Linda Stover, Bob Stover's widow. And Linda is somebody who, she's been a career, been in politics for her entire life. Her dad was Drew Cloud, who was the head of the Democratic Party in New Mexico. So, I mean, Linda is you would think would be a pretty cynical individual. She's not. She's a real public servant, but she is. It's few and far between people that you see in office. The judges, you have to be very, very careful as to who you elect as a judge. I'll tell you what, I would. You probably do more homework on who your babysitter is than who your judge is going, who you're going to elect as a judge. I mean, it's something in which we now there are consequences for decisions and actions and inaction, and so we are really reaping a disregard for the criminal justice system all the way up and down the line.
I agree with you. I think that people need to educate themselves on the records of judges and really understand, what kind of effect and impact these judges are having on our community. It starts there. It starts with the DA, and then it goes all the way up to the state legislature. Without really understanding, there's a lot of people, a lot of politicians that will tell you what you want to hear, and they'll be very slick and they'll be very smooth, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they're on your side or that they have your best interest at heart. And so I 100% agree with you on that. And that's something that I've, been learning as I've been doing this show is, every decision and every decision to not act and every decision to abstain from participating in the process has an impact. And you may not see it today, but it's going to come around and you're going to feel it at some point. And right now we're living with, some of the impacts from decisions that were made 1, 5, 10, 15 years ago. All of those things have piled up on us here. And, I hate to be the doom and gloom guy, but the more I dig into this stuff, the less happy I get about it. And so, who knows? I may run for office one day because I'm just so sick of all of this stuff. I do want to just take a moment. Go ahead.
Rick, I'll tell you what, if you can continue to be the champion for that particular kind of mindset, then you're going to be doing a tremendous public service. Because and believe me, you have to continue to do it all the time. It's something where people have to have their memories refreshed. And so I wish you the best. I'll tell you what, I think that It's exactly what the public has to hear. They have to hear the truth, even if it's a hard truth to have to bear. And they have to realize the time is running out. I mean, it really is. The clock is ticking on us. And so you keep up your fight. I'll tell you, my friend, that's exactly what has to happen.
Well, thank you, Greg. That means a lot coming from you. I have a lot of respect for you and for what you've done and for our community and for multiple communities. I can't thank you enough. And I'm so honored to have you on my show. I'd love to have you back sometime. Is there anything else that you'd like to say to my listeners before we wrap up this interview?
Well, just that, a lot of people don't realize what a wonderful state New Mexico is. I mean, from a physical standpoint, and all of the different all of the things that I miss in my life right now. And I live in a wonderful city and in a great area here in the Philippines. But I'll tell you what. There's nothing like New Mexico. It is the land of enchantment, but it can be so much better. And why people are continuing to put up with such substandard government service, the leadership, the political leadership in the state is absolutely horrendous. The educational level, I mean, there should be riots going on at every school. Because of the fact that you really the educators have let the young people down, and there is absolutely no excuse for it. The people that have led this state should hang their heads in shame, because they have dropped the ball, and it's got to be turned around, and it's going to be turned around by very, very. By the citizenry, by the people that truly do love the state. And so you keep up the battle, because I think you're right on the right track.
Thank you, Greg. I really appreciate you being on here today. And thank you to everybody who's listened. Don't forget to subscribe on all your favorite podcatchers and leave a review. Help other people find this show. If you want more information, Greg, where can people find you if they want to contact you or find information about Crime Stoppers?
There's Crime Stoppers USA that can be found on the internet. Crime Stoppers International also is on the internet, and of course, folks can always probably track me down through Facebook. I'm on Facebook. Email is gregorymack68@gmail.com. So they can always find me.
Awesome, Greg. Thank you so much, and thanks for listening, and stay safe, New Mexico. Thanks for listening to True Consequences. Follow me on Facebook and Instagram at True Consequences Pod and on Twitter at True Cons Pod. True Consequences is listener supported. If you'd like to support this one-man show, please go to patreon.com/true consequences. Thanks for listening, and stay safe, New Mexico.